The whisper of their voices echoed and rustled in the tunnel. If they dozed, they woke still to darkness and to silence going on unbroken. At last, after days and days of waiting, as it seemed, when they were becoming choked and dazed for want of air, they could bear it no longer. They would almost have welcomed sounds from below of the dragon's return. In the silence they feared some cunning devilry of his, but they could not sit there for ever. Thorin spoke.
"Let us try the door," he said. "I must feel the wind on my face soon or die. I think I would rather be smashed by Smaug in the open than suffocate in here."
So several of the dwarves got up and groped back to where the door had been. But they found that the upper end of the tunnel had been shattered and blocked with broken rock. Neither key nor the magic it had once obeyed would ever open that door again.
"We are trapped," they groaned. "This is the end. We shall die here."
But somehow, just when the dwarves were most despairing, Bilbo felt a strange lightening of the heart, as if a heavy weight had gone from under his waistcoat. "Come, come," he said. "While there's life, there's hope, as my father used to say, and third time pays for all. I'm going down the tunnel once again. I've been that way twice, when I knew there was a dragon at the other end, so I'll risk a third visit when I'm no longer sure. Anyway, the only way out is down, and I think this time you'd better all come with me." In desperation they agreed, and Thorin was the first to go forward by Bilbo's side. "Now do be careful," whispered the hobbit, "and as quiet as you can be. There may be no Smaug at the bottom, but then again there may be. Don't let us take any unnecessary risks." Down, down they went. The dwarves could not, of course, compare with the hobbit in real stealth, and they made a deal of puffing and shuffling, which echoes magnified alarmingly. But though every now and again Bilbo, in fear, stopped and listened, not a sound stirred below. Near the bottom, as well as he could judge, Bilbo slipped on his ring and went ahead. With such gloomy thoughts, followed ever by croaking crows above them, they made their weary way back to the camp. Only in June they had been guests in the fair house of Elrond, and though autumn was now crawling towards winter, that pleasant time now seemed years ago. They were alone in the perilous waste, without hope of further help. They were at the end of their journey, but as far as ever, it seemed, from the end of their quest. None of them had much spirit left. Now, strange to say, Mr. Baggins had more than the others. He would often borrow Thorin's map and gaze at it, pondering over the runes and the message of the moon letters Elrond had read. It was he that made the dwarves begin the dangerous search on the western slopes for the secret door. They moved their camp then to a long valley, narrower than the great dale in the south where the gates of the river stood, and walled with lower spurs of the mountain. Two of these here thrust forward west from the main mass in long steep-sided ridges that fell ever downwards towards the plain. On this western side there were fewer signs of the dragon's marauding feet, and there was some grass for their ponies. From this western camp, shadowed all day by cliff and wall until the sun began to sink towards the forest, day by day they toiled in parties, searching for paths up the mountainside. If the map was true, somewhere high above the cliff at the valley's head must stand the secret door. Day by day they came back to their camp without success. But at last, unexpectedly, they found what they were seeking. Feely and Keely and the hobbit went back one day down the valley and scrambled among the tumbled rocks at its southern corner. About midday, creeping behind a great stone that stood alone like a pillar, Bilbo came on what looked like rough steps going upwards. Following these excitedly, he and the dwarves found traces of a narrow track, often lost, often rediscovered, that wandered on to the top of the southern ridge and brought them at last to a still narrower ledge which turned north across the face of the mountain. Looking down, they saw that they were at the top of the cliff at the valley's head and were gazing down onto their own camp below. Silently, clinging to the rocky wall on their right, they went in single file along the ledge, till the wall opened and they turned into a little steep-walled bay, grassy-floored, still and quiet. Its entrance, which they had found, could not be seen from below because of the overhang of the cliff. But he did not need it. The darkness was complete, and they were all invisible, ring or no ring. In fact, so black was it that the hobbit came to the opening unexpectedly, put his hand on air, stumbled forward, and rolled headlong into the hall. There he lay face downwards on the floor and did not dare to get up, or hardly even to breathe. But nothing moved. There was not a gleam of light, unless, as it seemed to him, when at last he slowly raised his head, there was a pale white glint above him and far off in the gloom. But certainly it was not a spark of dragon fire, though the worm stench was heavy in the place, and the taste of vapour was on his tongue. At length Mr. Baggins could bear it no longer. "Confound you, Smaug, you worm!" he squeaked aloud. "Stop playing hide-and-seek. Give me a light, and then eat me, if you can catch me." Faint echoes ran round the unseen hall, but there was no answer. Bilbo got up and found that he did not know in what direction to turn. "Now I wonder what on earth Smaug is playing at," he said. "He's not at home today, or tonight, or whatever it is, I do believe. If Oin and Gloin have not lost their tinder-boxes, perhaps we can make a little light and have a look round before the luck turns." "Light!" he cried. "Could anybody make a light?" The dwarves, of course, were very alarmed when Bilbo fell forward down the step with a bump into the hall, and they sat huddled just where he had left them, at the end of the tunnel. "Shh! Shh!" they hissed when they heard his voice. And though that helped the hobbit to find out where they were, it was some time before he could get anything else out of them. But in the end, when Bilbo actually began to stamp on the floor and screamed out, "Light!" at the top of his shrill voice, Thorin gave way, and Oin and Gloin were sent back to their bundles at the top of the tunnel. After a while, a twinkling gleam showed them returning, Oin with a small pine torch alight in his hand, and Gloin with a bundle of others under his arm. Quickly Bilbo trotted to the door and took the torch, but he could not persuade the dwarves to light the others or to come and join him yet. As Thorin carefully explained, Mr. Baggins was still officially their expert burglar and investigator. If he liked to risk a light, that was his affair. They would wait in the tunnel for his report. So they sat near the door and watched. Nor from further off, because it was so small that it looked like a dark crack and no more. It was not a cave, and was open to the sky above, but at its inner end a flat wall rose up that in the lower part, close to the ground, was as smooth and upright as mason's work, but without a joint or crevice to be seen. No sign was there of post or lintel or threshold, nor any sign of bar or bolt or keyhole, yet they did not doubt that they had found the door at last. They beat on it. They thrust and pushed at it. They implored it to move. They spoke fragments of broken spells of opening, and nothing stirred. At last, tired out, they rested on the grass at its feet, and then at evening began their long climb down. There was excitement in the camp that night. In the morning they prepared to move once more. Only Beaufort and Bomba were left behind to guard the ponies and such stores as they had brought with them from the river. The others went down the valley and up the newly found path and so to the narrow ledge. Along this they could carry no bundles or packs, so narrow and breathless was it, with a fall of 150 feet beside them onto sharp rocks below. But each of them took a good coil of rope wound tight about his waist, and so at last, without mishap, they reached the little grassy bay. There they made their third camp, hauling up what they needed from below with their ropes. Down the same way, they were able occasionally to lower one of the more active dwarves, such as Keeley, to exchange such news as there was, or to take a share in the guard below, while Beaufort was hauled up to the higher camp. Bomba would not come up either the rope or the path.
"I am too fat for such fly walks," he said. "I should turn dizzy and tread on my beard, and then you would be 13 again, and the knotted ropes are too slender for my weight."
Luckily for him, that was not true, as you will see. In the meantime, some of them explored the ledge beyond the opening and found a path that led higher and higher onto the mountain. Yet they didn't dare to venture very far that way, nor was there much use in it. Out up there a silence reigned, broken by no bird or sound except that of the wind in the crannies of stone. They spoke low and never called or sang, for danger brooded in every rock. They saw the little dark shape of the hobbit start across the floor, holding his tiny light aloft. Every now and again, while he was still near enough, they caught a glint and a tinkle as he stumbled on some golden thing. The light grew smaller as he wandered away into the vast hall. Then it began to rise, dancing into the air. Bilbo was climbing the great mound of treasure. Soon he stood upon the top and still went on. Then they saw him halt and stoop for a moment, but they did not know the reason. It was the Arkenstone, the heart of the mountain. So Bilbo guessed from Thorin's description. But indeed, there could not be two such gems, even in so marvellous a hoard, even in all the world. Ever as he climbed, the same white gleam had shone before him and drawn his feet towards it. Slowly it grew to a little globe of pallid light. Now, as he came near, it was tinged with a flickering sparkle of many colours at the surface, reflected and splintered from the wavering light of his torch. At last he looked down upon it, and he caught his breath. The great jewel shone before his feet of its own inner light, and yet, cut and fashioned by the dwarves, who had dug it from the heart of the mountain long ago, it took all light that fell upon it, and changed it into 10,000 sparks of white radiance, shot with glints of the rainbow. Suddenly Bilbo's arm went towards it, drawn by its enchantment. His small hand would not close about it, for it was a large and heavy gem. But he lifted it, shut his eyes, and put it in his deepest pocket. "Now I am a burglar indeed," thought he. "But I suppose I must tell the dwarves about it, sometime. They did say I could pick and choose my own share, and I think I'd choose this if they took all the rest." All the same, he had an uncomfortable feeling that the picking and choosing had not really been meant to include this marvellous gem, and that trouble would yet come of it. Now he went on again. Down the other side of the great mound he climbed, and the spark of his torch vanished from the sight of the watching dwarves. But soon they saw it far away in the distance again. The others who were busy with the secret of the door had no more success. They were too eager to trouble about the runes or the moon letters, but tried without resting to discover where exactly in the smooth face of the rock the door was hidden. They had brought picks and tools of many sorts from Lake Town, and at first they tried to use these. But when they struck the stone, the handle splintered and jarred their arms cruelly, and the steel heads broke or bent like lead. Mining work, they saw clearly, was no good against the magic that had shut this door, and they grew terrified, too, of the echoing noise. Bilbo found sitting on the doorstep lonesome and wearisome. There was not a doorstep, of course, really, but they used to call the little grassy space between the wall and the opening the doorstep in fun. Remembering Bilbo's words long ago at the unexpected party in his hobbit hole, when he said they could sit on the doorstep till they thought of something. And sit and think they did, or wandered aimlessly about, and glummer they became. Their spirits had risen a little at the discovery of the path, but now they sank into their boots, and yet they would not give it up and go away. The hobbit was no longer much brighter than the dwarves. He would do nothing but sit with his back to the rock face and stare away west through the opening, over the cliff, over the wide lands to the black wall of Mirkwood, and to the distances beyond, in which he sometimes thought he could catch glimpses of the misty mountains, small and far. If the dwarves asked him what he was doing, he answered, "You said sitting on the doorstep and thinking would be my job, not to mention getting inside. So I'm sitting and thinking." But I'm afraid he was not thinking much of the job, but of what lay beyond the blue distance, the quiet western land and the hill and his hobbit hole under it. A large grey stone lay in the centre of the grass, and he stared moodily at it, or watched the great snails. They seemed to love the little shut-in bay with its walls of cool rock, and there were many of them of huge size, crawling slowly and stickily along its sides.
"Tomorrow begins the last week of autumn," said Thorin one day. "And winter comes after autumn," said Bifur. "And next year after that," said Dwalin, "and our beards will grow till they hang down the cliff to the valley before anything happens here."
Bilbo was crossing the floor of the hall. He went on until he came to the great doors at the further side, and there a draught of air refreshed him, but it almost puffed out his light. He peeped timidly through and caught a glimpse of great passages and of the dim beginnings of wide stairs going up into the gloom. And still there was no sight nor sound of Smaug. He was just going to turn and go back when a black shape swooped at him and brushed his face. He squeaked and started, stumbled backwards and fell. His torch dropped head downwards and went out.
"Only a bat, I suppose, and hope," he said miserably. "But now what am I to do? Which is east, south, north, or west? Thorin, Balin, Oin, Gloin, Feely, Keely," he cried as loud as he could. It seemed a thin little noise in the wide blackness. "The light's gone out. Someone come and find me and help me." For the moment his courage had failed altogether. Faintly the dwarves heard his small cries, though the only word they could catch was, "Help."
"Now what on earth or under it has happened?" said Thorin. "Certainly not the dragon, or he would not go on squeaking."
They waited a moment or two, and still there were no dragon noises, no sound at all, in fact, but Bilbo's distant voice.
"Come, one of you, get another light or two," Thorin ordered. "It seems we've got to go and help our burglar."
"It's about our turn to help," said Balin, "and I'm quite willing to go. Anyway, I expect it's safe for the moment."
Gloin lit several more torches, and then they all crept out, one by one, and went along the wall as hurriedly as they could. It was not long before they met Bilbo himself, coming back towards them. His wits had quickly returned as soon as he saw the twinkle of their lights.
"Only a bat and a dropped torch, nothing worse," he said in answer to their questions. Though they were much relieved, they were inclined to be grumpy at being frightened for nothing. But what they would have said, if he had told them at that moment about the Arkenstone, I don't know. The mere fleeting glimpses of treasure, which they had caught as they went along, had rekindled all the fire of their dwarvish hearts. And when the heart of a dwarf, even the most respectable, is wakened by gold and by jewels, he grows suddenly bold, and he may become fierce.
"What's our burglar doing for us? Since he's got an invisible ring and ought to be a specially excellent performer now, I'm beginning to think he might go through the front gate and spy things out a bit."
Bilbo heard this. The dwarves were on the rocks just above the enclosure where he was sitting, and, "Good gracious," he thought, "so that is what they're beginning to think, is it? It is always poor me that has to get them out of their difficulties, at least since the wizard left. Whatever am I going to do? I might have known that something dreadful would happen to me in the end. I don't think I could bear to see the unhappy Valley of Dale again, and as for that steaming gate." That night he was very miserable and hardly slept. Next day the dwarves all went wandering off in various directions. Some were exercising the ponies down below, some were roving about the mountainside. All day Bilbo sat gloomily in the grassy bay gazing at the stone, or out west through the narrow opening. He had a queer feeling that he was waiting for something. "Perhaps the wizard will suddenly come back today," he thought. If he lifted his head, he could see a glimpse of the distant forest. As the sun turned west, there was a gleam of yellow upon its far roof, as if the light caught the last pale leaves. Soon he saw the orange ball of the sun sinking towards the level of his eyes. He went to the opening, and there, pale and faint, was a thin new moon above the rim of earth. At that very moment he heard a sharp crack behind him. There, on the grey stone in the grass, was an enormous thrush, nearly coal black, its pale yellow breast freckled with dark spots. Crack! It had caught a snail and was knocking it on the stone. Crack! Crack! Suddenly Bilbo understood. Forgetting all danger, he stood on the ledge and hailed the dwarves, shouting and waving. The dwarves, indeed, no longer needed any urging. All were now eager to explore the hall while they had the chance, and willing to believe that, for the present, Smaug was away from home. Each now gripped a lighted torch, and as they gazed, first on one side and then on another, they forgot fear and even caution. They spoke aloud, and cried one to another, as they lifted old treasures from the mound or from the wall, and held them in the light, caressing and fingering them. Feely and Keely were almost in merry mood, and finding, still hanging there, many golden harps strung with silver, they took them and struck them, and being magical, and also untouched by the dragon, who had small interest in music, they were still in tune. The dark hall was filled with a melody that had long been silent, but most of the dwarves were more practical. They gathered gems and stuffed their pockets, and let what they could not carry fall back through their fingers with a sigh. Thorin was not least among these, but always he searched from side to side for something which he could not find. It was the Arkenstone. But he spoke of it yet to no one. Now the dwarves took down mail and weapons from the walls and armed themselves. Royal indeed did Thorin look, clad in a coat of gold-plated rings, with a silver-hafted axe and a belt crusted with scarlet stones.
"Mr. Baggins," he cried, "here is the first payment of your reward. Cast off your old coat and put on this."
With that he put on Bilbo a small coat of mail, wrought for some young elf prince long ago. It was of silver steel, which the elves call mithril, and with it went a belt of pearls and crystals. A light helm of figured leather, strengthened beneath with hoops of steel, and studded about the brim with white gems, was set upon the hobbit's head.
"I feel magnificent," he thought, "but I expect I look rather absurd. How they would laugh on the hill at home! Still, I wish there was a looking-glass handy."
All the same, Mr. Baggins kept his head more clear of the bewitchment of the hoard than the dwarves did. Long before the dwarves were tired of examining the treasures, he became weary of it and sat down on the floor. And he began to wonder nervously what the end of it all would be.
"I'd give a good many of these precious goblets," he thought, "for a drink of something cheering out of one of Bjorn's wooden bowls."
Those that were nearest came tumbling over the rocks and as fast as they could along the ledge to him, wondering what on earth was the matter. The others shouted to be hauled up the ropes, except Bomba, of course. He was asleep. Quickly Bilbo explained. They all fell silent, the hobbit standing by the grey stone, and the dwarves with wagging beards watching impatiently. The sun sank lower and lower, and their hopes fell. It sank into a belt of reddened cloud and disappeared. The dwarves groaned, but still Bilbo stood almost without moving. The little moon was dipping to the horizon. Evening was coming on. Then suddenly, when their hope was lowest, a red ray of the sun escaped like a finger through a rent in the cloud. A gleam of light came straight through the opening into the bay and fell on the smooth rock face. The old thrush, who had been watching from a high perch with beady eyes and head cocked on one side, gave a sudden trill. There was a loud crack. A flake of rock split from the wall and fell. A hole appeared suddenly about 3 feet from the ground. Quickly, trembling lest the chance should fade, the dwarves rushed to the rock and pushed. In vain.
"The key! The key!" cried Bilbo. "Where is Thorin?"
Thorin hurried up.
"The key!" shouted Bilbo. "The key that went with the map. Try it now while there's still time."
Then Thorin stepped up and drew the key on its chain from round his neck. He put it to the hole. It fitted and it turned. Snap! The gleam went out, the sun sank, the moon was gone, and evening sprang into the sky. Now they all pushed together, and slowly a part of the rock wall gave way. Long, straight cracks appeared and widened. A door 5 feet high and 3 broad was outlined, and slowly, without a sound, swung inwards. It seemed as if darkness flowed out like a vapour from the hole in the mountainside, and deep darkness in which nothing could be seen lay before their eyes, a yawning mouth leading in and down.
"Thorin," he cried aloud, "what next? We are armed, but what good has any armour ever been before against Smaug the dragon? This treasure is not yet won back. We are not looking for gold yet, but for a way of escape, and we've tempted luck too long."
"You speak the truth," answered Thorin, recovering his wits. "Let us go. I will guide you. Not in 1,000 years should I forget the ways of this palace."
Then he hailed the others, and they gathered together, and holding their torches above their heads, they passed through the gaping doors, not without many a backward glance of longing. Their glittering mail they had covered again with their old cloaks, and their bright helms with their tattered hoods, and one by one they walked behind Thorin, a line of little lights in the darkness that halted often, listening in fear once more for any rumour of the dragon's coming. Though all the old adornments were long moulded or destroyed, and though all was befouled and blasted with the comings and goings of the monster, Thorin knew every passage and every turn. They climbed long stairs, and turned and went down wide echoing ways, and turned again and climbed yet more stairs, and yet more stairs again. These were smooth, cut out of the living rock, broad and fair, and up, up the dwarves went, and they met no sign of any living thing. Only furtive shadows that fled from the approach of their torches fluttering in the draughts. The steps were not made, all the same, for hobbit legs, and Bilbo was just feeling that he could go on no longer, when suddenly the roof sprang high and far beyond the reach of their torchlight. A white glimmer could be seen coming through some opening far above, and the air smelt sweeter. Before them light came dimly through great doors, that hung twisted on their hinges and half-burnt.
"This is the great chamber of Thror," said Thorin, "the hall of feasting and of council. Not far off now is the front gate."
They passed through the ruined chamber. Tables were rotting there, chairs and benches were lying there overturned, charred and decaying. Skulls and bones were upon the floor, among flagons and bowls and broken drinking horns and dust. As they came through yet more doors at the further end, a sound of water fell upon their ears, and the grey light grew suddenly more full. Chapter 12. Inside Information. For a long time the dwarves stood in the dark before the door and debated, until at last Thorin spoke.
"Now is the time for our esteemed Mr. Baggins, who has proved himself a good companion on our long road, and a hobbit full of courage and resource far exceeding his size, and I may say so possessed of good luck far exceeding the usual allowance. Now is the time for him to perform the service for which he was included in our company. Now is the time for him to earn his reward."
You are familiar with Thorin's style on important occasions, so I will not give you any more of it, though he went on a good deal longer than this. It certainly was an important occasion, but Bilbo felt impatient. By now he was quite familiar with Thorin too, and he knew what he was driving at. "If you mean you think it's my job to go into the secret passages first, O Thorin Thrain's son Oakenshield, may your beard grow ever longer," he said crossly. "Say so at once and have done. I might refuse. I've got you out of two messes already, which were hardly in the original bargain, so that I am, I think, already owed some reward. But third time pays for all, as my father used to say, and somehow I don't think I shall refuse. Perhaps I've begun to trust my luck more than I used to in the old days." He meant last spring, before he left his own house, but it seemed centuries ago. "But anyway, I think I'll go and have a peep at once and get it over. Now, who's coming with me?" He did not expect a chorus of volunteers, so he was not disappointed. Feely and Keely looked uncomfortable and stood on one leg, but the others made no pretense of offering, except old Barlin, the lookout man, who was rather fond of the hobbit. He said he would come inside at least, and perhaps a bit of the way too, ready to call for help if necessary. The most that can be said for the dwarves is this. They intended to pay Bilbo really handsomely for his services. They had brought him to do a nasty job for them, and they didn't mind the poor little fellow doing it if he would. But they would all have done their best to get him out of trouble, if he got into it, as they did in the case of the trolls at the beginning of their adventures, before they had any particular reasons for being grateful to him.
"There is the birth of the running river," said Thorin. "From here it hastens to the gate. Let us follow it."
Out of a dark opening in a wall of rock, there issued a boiling water, and it flowed swirling in a narrow channel, carved and made straight and deep by the cunning of ancient hands. Beside it ran a stone-paved road, wide enough for many men abreast. Swiftly along this they ran, and round a wide-sweeping turn, and behold, before them stood the broad light of day. In front there rose a tall arch, still showing the fragments of old carven work within, worn and splintered and blackened though it was. A misty sun sent its pale light between the arms of the mountain, and beams of gold fell on the pavements at the threshold. A whirl of bats, frightened from slumber by their smoking torches, flooded over them. As they sprang forward, their feet slithered on stones rubbed smooth and slimed by the passing of the dragon. Now before them, the water fell noisily outward and foamed down towards the valley. They flung their pale torches to the ground and stood gazing out with dazzled eyes. They were come to the front gate and were looking out upon Dale.
"Well," said Bilbo, "I never expected to be looking out of this door, and I never expected to be so pleased to see the sun again, and to feel the wind on my face. But oh, this wind is cold."
It was. A bitter easterly breeze blew with a threat of oncoming winter. It swirled over and round the arms of the mountain into the valley, and sighed among the rocks. After their long time in the stewing depths of the dragon-haunted caverns, they shivered in the sun. Suddenly Bilbo realized that he was not only tired, but also very hungry indeed.
"It seems to be late morning," he said, "and so I suppose it's more or less breakfast time, if there's any breakfast to have. But I don't feel that Smaug's front doorstep is the safest place for a meal. Do let's go somewhere where we can sit quiet for a bit."
"Quite right," said Balin. "And I think I know which way we should go. We ought to make for the old lookout post at the southwest corner of the mountain."
"How far is that?" asked the hobbit.
5 hours' march, I should think. It will be rough going. The road from the gate along the left edge of the stream seems all broken up. But look down there."
There it is. Dwarves are not heroes, but calculating folk with a great idea of the value of money. Some are tricky and treacherous and pretty bad lots. Some are not, but are decent enough people like Thorin and company if you don't expect too much. The stars were coming out behind him in a pale sky barred with black when the hobbit crept through the enchanted door and stole into the mountain. It was far easier going than he expected. This was no goblin entrance or rough wood elves' cave. It was a passage made by dwarves, at the height of their wealth and skill, straight as a ruler, smooth-floored and smooth-sided, going with a gentle, never-varying slope direct to some distant end in the blackness below. After a while, Balin bade Bilbo, "Good luck," and stopped where he could still see the faint outline of the door, and by a trick of the echoes of the tunnel, hear the rustle of the whispering voices of the others just outside. Then the hobbit slipped on his ring, and warned by the echoes to take more than hobbit's care to make no sound, he crept noiselessly down, down, down into the dark. He was trembling with fear, but his little face was set and grim. Already he was a very different hobbit from the one that had run out without a pocket handkerchief from Bag End long ago. He had not had a pocket handkerchief for ages. He loosened his dagger in its sheath, tightened his belt, and went on. "Now you're in for it at last, Bilbo Baggins," he said to himself. "You went and put your foot right in it that night of the party, and now you've got to pull it out and pay for it. Dear me, what a fool I was, and am," said the least tookish part of him. "I have absolutely no use for dragon-guarded treasures, and the whole lot could stay here forever, if only I could wake up and find this beastly tunnel was my own front hall at home." He didn't wake up, of course, but went still on and on, till all sign of the door behind had faded away. He was altogether alone. Soon he thought it was beginning to feel warm. "Is that a kind of a glow I seem to see coming right ahead down there?" he thought. The river loops suddenly east across Dale in front of the ruined town. At that point there was once a bridge, leading to steep stairs that climbed up the right bank, and so to a road running towards Ravenhill. There is, or was, a path that left the road and climbed up to the post. A hard climb, too, even if the old steps are still there. "Dear me," grumbled the hobbit, "more walking and more climbing without breakfast. I wonder how many breakfasts and other meals we've missed inside that nasty, clockless, timeless hole." As a matter of fact, two nights and the day between had gone by, and not altogether without food, since the dragon smashed the magic door. But Bilbo had quite lost count, and it might have been one night or a week of nights, for all he could tell. "Come, come," said Thorin, laughing. His spirits had begun to rise again, and he rattled the precious stones in his pockets. "Don't call my place a nasty hole. You wait till it's been cleaned and redecorated." "That won't be till Smaug's dead," said Bilbo glumly. "In the meantime, where is he? I would give a good breakfast to know. I hope he's not up on the mountain looking down at us." That idea disturbed the dwarves mightily, and they quickly decided that Bilbo and Balin were right.
"We must move away from here," said Dori. "I feel as if his eyes were on the back of my head."
"It's a cold, lonesome place," said Bomba. "There may be drink, but I see no sign of food. A dragon would always be hungry in such parts."
"Come on, come on," cried the others. "Let us follow Balin's path."
Under the rocky wall to the right there was no path, so on they trudged among the stones on the left side of the river, and the emptiness and desolation soon sobered even Thorin again. The bridge that Balin had spoken of they found long fallen, and most of its stones were now only boulders in the shallow, noisy stream, but they forded the water without much difficulty, and found the ancient steps, and climbed the high bank. After going a short way, they struck the old road, and before long came to a deep dell sheltered among the rocks. There they rested for a while, and had such a breakfast as they could, chiefly cram and water. If you want to know what cram is, I can only say that I don't know the recipe, but it is biscuitish, keeps good indefinitely, is supposed to be sustaining, and is certainly not entertaining, being in fact very uninteresting, except as a chewing exercise. It was made by the lake men for long journeys. It was. As he went forward, it grew and grew, till there was no doubt about it. It was a red light steadily getting redder and redder. Also, it was now undoubtedly hot in the tunnel. Wisps of vapour floated up and past him, and he began to sweat. A sound, too, began to throb in his ears, a sort of bubbling like the noise of a large pot galloping on the fire, mixed with a rumble as of a gigantic tomcat purring. This grew to the unmistakable gurgling noise of some vast animal snoring in its sleep down there in the red glow in front of him. It was at this point that Bilbo stopped. Going on from there was the bravest thing he ever did. The tremendous things that happened afterward were as nothing compared to it. He fought the real battle in the tunnel alone, before he ever saw the vast danger that lay in wait. At any rate, after a short halt, go on he did, and you can picture him coming to the end of the tunnel, an opening of much the same size and shape as the door above. Through it peeps the hobbit's little head. Before him lies the great bottom-most cellar or dungeon hall of the ancient dwarves right at the mountain's root. It is almost dark, so that its vastness can only be dimly guessed, but rising from the near side of the rocky floor there is a great glow, the glow of Smaug. There he lay, a vast red-golden dragon, fast asleep. A thrumming came from his jaws and nostrils, and wisps of smoke, but his fires were low in slumber. Beneath him, under all his limbs and his huge coiled tail, and about him on all sides stretching away across the unseen floors, lay countless piles of precious things, gold wrought and unwrought, gems and jewels, and silver red-stained in the ruddy light. Smaug lay, with wings folded like an immeasurable bat, turned partly on one side, so that the hobbit could see his underparts and his long, pale belly crusted with gems and fragments of gold from his long lying on his costly bed. Behind him, where the walls were nearest, could dimly be seen coats of mail, helms and axes, swords and spears hanging, and there in rows stood great jars and vessels filled with a wealth that could not be guessed. After that they went on again, and now the road struck westwards and left the river, and the great shoulder of the south-pointing mountain spur drew ever nearer. At length they reached the hill path. It scrambled steeply up, and they plodded slowly, one behind the other, till at last, in the late afternoon, they came to the top of the ridge and saw the wintry sun going downwards to the west. Here they found a flat place without a wall on three sides, but backed to the north by a rocky face in which there was an opening like a door. From that door there was a wide view east and south and west. "Here," said Balin, "in the old days we used always to keep watchmen, and that door behind leads into a rock-hewn chamber that was made here as a guard-room. There were several places like it round the mountain, but there seemed small need for watching in the days of our prosperity, and the guards were made over-comfortable, perhaps. Otherwise we might have had longer warnings of the coming of the dragon, and things might have been different. Still, here we can now lie hid and sheltered for a while, and can see much without being seen."
"Not much use, if we've been seen coming here," said Dorry, who was always looking up towards the mountain's peak, as if he expected to see Smaug perched there like a bird on a steeple.
"We must take our chance of that," said Thorin. "We can go no further today."
"Hear, hear," cried Bilbo, and flung himself on the ground. In the rock chamber there would have been room for 100, and there was a small chamber further in, more removed from the cold outside. It was quite deserted. Not even wild animals seemed to have used it in all the days of Smaug's dominion. There they laid their burdens, and some threw themselves down at once and slept. But the others sat near the outer door and discussed their plans. In all their talk they came perpetually back to one thing. Where was Smaug? They looked west, and there was nothing. And east, and there was nothing. and in the south there was no sign of the dragon, but there was a gathering of very many birds. At that they gazed and wondered. But they were no nearer understanding it when the first cold stars came out.
To say that Bilbo's breath was taken away is no description at all. There are no words left to express his staggerment, since men changed the language that they learned of elves in the days when all the world was wonderful. Bilbo had heard tell and sing of dragon hordes before, but the splendour, the lust, the glory of such treasure had never yet come home to him. His heart was filled and pierced with enchantment and with the desire of dwarves, and he gazed motionless, almost forgetting the frightful guardian, at the gold beyond price and count. He gazed for what seemed an age, before, drawn almost against his will, he stole from the shadow of the doorway across the floor to the nearest edge of the mounds of treasure. Above him the sleeping dragon lay, a dire menace even in his sleep. He grasped a great two-handled cup, as heavy as he could carry, and cast one fearful eye upwards. Smaug stirred a wing, opened a claw. The rumble of his snoring changed its note. Then Bilbo fled. But the dragon did not wake, not yet, but shifted into other dreams of greed and violence, lying there in his stolen hall while the little hobbit toiled back up the long tunnel. His heart was beating, and a more fevered shaking was in his legs than when he was going down, but still he clutched the cup, and his chief thought was, "I've done it! This will show them! More like a grocer than a burglar, indeed! Well, we'll hear no more of that!" Nor did he. Balin was overjoyed to see the hobbit again, and as delighted as he was surprised. He picked Bilbo up and carried him out into the open air. It was midnight, and clouds had covered the stars, but Bilbo lay with his eyes shut, gasping and taking pleasure in the feel of the fresh air again, and hardly noticing the excitement of the dwarves, or how they praised him and patted him on the back, and put themselves and all their families for generations to come at his service. The dwarves were still passing the cup from hand to hand, and talking delightedly of the recovery of their treasure, when suddenly a vast rumbling woke in the mountain underneath, as if it was an old volcano that had made up its mind to start eruptions once again. Chapter 14. Fire and Water. Now, if you wish, like the dwarves, to hear news of Smaug, you must go back again to the evening when he smashed the door and flew off in rage 2 days before. The men of the lake town Esgaroth were mostly indoors, for the breeze was from the black east and chill, but a few were walking on the quays and watching, as they were fond of doing, the stars shine out from the smooth patches of the lake as they opened in the sky. From their town the lonely mountain was mostly screened by the low hills at the far end of the lake, through a gap in which the running river came down from the north. Only its high peak could they see in clear weather, and they seldom looked at it, for it was ominous and drear, even in the light of morning. Now it was lost and gone, blotted in the dark. Suddenly it flickered back to view. A brief glow touched it and faded. "Look," said one, "the lights again. Last night the watchman saw them start and fade from midnight until dawn. Something's happening up there. Perhaps the king under the mountain is forging gold," said another. "It's long since he went north. It is time the songs began to prove themselves again." "Which king?" said another with a grim voice. "As like as not it is the marauding fire of the dragon.
the only king under the mountain we've ever known. You're always foreboding gloomy things, said the others. Anything from floods to poisoned fish. Think of something cheerful. Then suddenly a great light appeared in the low place in the hills, and the northern end of the lake turned golden.
The king beneath the mountain, they shouted. His wealth is like the sun, his silver like a fountain, his rivers golden run. The river is running gold from the mountain, they cried, and everywhere windows were opened and feet were hurrying.
There was once more a tremendous excitement and enthusiasm, but the grim-voiced fellow ran hot-foot to the master.
The dragon is coming, or I'm a fool, he cried. Cut the bridges! To arms! To arms!
Then warning trumpets were suddenly sounded, and echoed along the rocky shores. The cheering stopped, and the joy was turned to dread. So it was that the dragon did not find them quite unprepared. Before long, so great was his speed, they could see him as a spark of walking towards them and growing ever huger and more bright, and not the most foolish doubted that the prophecies had gone rather wrong. Still, they had a little time. The door behind them was pulled nearly to, and blocked from closing with a stone, but up the long tunnel came the dreadful echoes from far down in the depths of a bellowing and a trampling that made the ground beneath them tremble. Then the dwarves forgot their joy and their confident boasts of a moment before, and cowered down in fright. Smaug was still to be reckoned with. It does not do to leave a live dragon out of your calculations if you live near him. Dragons may not have much real use for all their wealth, but they know it to an ounce as a rule, especially after long possession, and Smaug was no exception. He had passed from an uneasy dream, in which a warrior, although altogether insignificant in size, but provided with a bitter sword and great courage, figured most unpleasantly, to a doze, and from a doze to wide waking. There was a breath of strange air in his cave. Could there be a draught from that little hole? He had never felt quite happy about it, though it was so small, and now he glared at it in suspicion, and wondered why he had never blocked it up. Of late, he had half fancied he had caught the dim echoes of a knocking sound from far above that came down through it to his lair. He stirred and stretched forth his neck to sniff. Then he missed the cup. Thieves! Fire! Murder! Such a thing had not happened since first he came to the mountain. His rage passes description. The sort of rage that is only seen when rich folk, that have more than they can enjoy, suddenly lose something that they have long had, but have never before used or wanted. His fire belched forth. The hall smoked. He shook the mountain roots. He thrust his head in vain at the little hole, and then, coiling his length together, roaring like thunder underground, he sped from his deep lair through its great door, out into the huge passages of the mountain palace, and up towards the front gate. To hunt the whole mountain till he had caught the thief and had torn and trampled him was his one thought. He issued from the gate. The waters rose in fierce whistling steam, and up he soared, blazing into the air, and settled on the mountain top in a spout of green and scarlet flame. The dwarves heard the awful rumour of his flight, and they crouched against the walls of the grassy terrace, cringing under boulders, hoping somehow to escape the frightful eyes of the hunting dragon. There they would have all been killed, if it had not been for Bilbo once again.
"Quick! Quick!" he gasped. "The door! The tunnel! It's no good here!"
Roused by these words, they were just about to creep inside the tunnel, when Bifur gave a cry.
"My cousins, Bumper and Bofur, we've forgotten them. They're down in the valley.
They'll be slain, and all our ponies too, and all our stores lost," moaned the others. "We can do nothing."
"Nonsense," said Thorin, recovering his dignity. We cannot leave them. Get inside, Mr. Baggins and Barlin, and you two, Feely and Keeley. The dragon shan't have all of us. Now, you others, where are the ropes? Be quick.